ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Annabelle Crabb. Now, I wouldn't say I'm a hoarder exactly, but I do hang on to things. It's not just you and me. Australia's oldest library is crammed with stuff that isn't books. Terrible paintings, old menus, human hair. Is this history or hoarding? Come and have a rummage through the story of us, told by our stuff. Search for the History or Hoarding podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. I'm David Marr. John Safran has been making mischief in books, on radio and on the screen for years, and he's now about to release a documentary called Shut Your Big Fat Mouth, John Safran, which explores the limits of what we can and can't say in Australia these days. Shut Your Big Fat Mouth shows him to be not quite the freewheeling troublemaker he once was. John joins us later. And we're talking to a scholar who reckons he's identified the original blind Freddy. Not actually blind, but the idiot son of an aristocrat making a mess of his life in colonial Australia. It's a wonderful tale. But first to the United States, where Bruce Shapiro is standing by at breakfast time in New Haven, Connecticut. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Always good to be here.
Bruce, the war in Iran, is anything actually going on?
Well, there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, and clearly for Donald Trump, the war that he and Bibi Netanyahu started in February, which was estimated to be over in 5 to 6 weeks, 3 months later, is still an active problem. It gets less and less popular, yet Trump himself keeps threatening to renew military escalation, renew bombing, and then pulls back. Look, the fundamental dynamic of this war has not changed, which is that neither side wants to lose face. Within the United States, even Republicans recognize that politically this was a war started without support, without an argument, and without an end game. And now the president has to decide how to get out of it. Yesterday he said, well, I'm ready to start bombing. But then he turned around and said, well, actually, Qatar and Saudi Arabia and the UAE have asked him to continue the ceasefire. The war is an immense political problem because everyone knows it is A, unpopular, B, is sending the U.S. economy, the economy of the Mideast, and ultimately the global economy into a tailspin. It completely overshadowed President Trump's brief trip to China. He's got a big problem on his hands.
And his approval rating is now pretty much lower than a president has seen for
years. It's the lowest second term at this point rating. It's down to 30%. Okay, he simply has not been able to get any traction outside of the quarter to third of the electorate who are the hard Trump faction, and this in turn, of course, has continued enormous implications the closer we get to November.
But there are quite a few reasons to think it isn't going to lead to a rout at the midterms.
Well, the math in the midterms has, over the course of the last week or so, changed in very dramatic ways. You know, listeners who were with us a couple weeks ago will remember that the Supreme Court and its Republican-appointed conservative majority very abruptly ruled that historically that majority minority or mostly black election districts making up for historic segregation in the Old South are now unconstitutional. And over the course of the last couple of weeks, we've seen Republicans rush to try to draw new electoral maps for the midterms, which have fundamentally changed the math. Start with Virginia. In Virginia, back earlier this spring, the state had voted a new electoral map that would have given Democrats, actually, four additional seats in Congress, four additional majority Democratic districts. Those have now been clawed back by the state legislature and an appeal rejected by the U.S. Supreme Court. Texas, Indiana, other states, even South Carolina, which is where there's exactly one black legislator, the chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus, James Clyburn, legendary elder statesman of black politics. Republicans are trying to gerrymander his district out of existence. And suddenly what looked like a very comfortable margin for Democrats retaking the House in the fall now is, you know, at best a 50-50 proposition.
Bruce, Australians look at this just in complete disbelief, you know, that this is all allowed. You can't do it in this country.
Well, it's a uniquely American problem, yep, having to do with the balance of power between federal government and state and the long, long, long tail of segregation,
yep,
which is
Jim Crow is still hard at work. But Bruce, there's... Re-election is not everything that Trump wants here, because he's making sure that popular Republicans out there in America who have crossed him will be disendorsed. And,
well,
you know, the main game here for him is the absolute control of his party.
Yes. And look, this is sometimes being framed as retribution. I actually think that's a mistaken word. It plays into Trump's own trope, I am your retribution. It is, David, exactly what you said. It is about dictatorial control of his own party. And we saw this over the course of the last week in Louisiana, where there was a Republican primary for the U.S. Senate. Bill Cassidy, conservative Republican in every conceivable way, economically, on abortion, on race, on all kinds of things, not a moderate Republican, traditional conservative Republican in that office for years, made the mistake back in 2021 of being one of the Republicans who voted for the impeachment of Donald Trump after the January 6th insurrection. Trump backed not one but two opposition candidates to Cassidy in Louisiana. Cassidy lost. And this is only one example. There's all kinds of folks at lower levels whom the MAGA wing of the party has gone after. In Indiana, there were six legislators who, Republicans, again, mostly conservatives in a pretty conservative state, who had stood up to an attempt to gerrymander Democratic majority or black majority districts out of existence. They were wiped out in a primary this spring as well. And now we're going to see, I think, something like that happen in South Carolina, where there was one lone Republican who, in a closely divided legislature, was enough to swing an attempt, suppress an attempt to very quickly get rid of Clyburn's district, which we were just talking about. Yeah. And that legislator, I think, is likely to be wiped out in the next round of primary elections. So, you know, this is the grip that Trump and his machine still have on the Republican Party. The interesting thing, though, is that even as his grip grows, and even as these redistricting victories, these gerrymandering victories rise, it's gerrymandering for a narrower and narrower Republican base, while, you know, while the Republicans are giving themselves more and more majority districts, whether their traditional margins of voters will actually show up, or whether this will be a highly motivated Democratic wave election anyway, remains a very alive question.
Because nobody's particularly enthusiastic about the Democrats.
Well, we don't know this yet. There's some very big fighting going on among Democrats. We've had some progressive victories, Greg Planter and Wayne in Maine, Senate candidate, who totally outran the Democratic but much more moderate governor of that state to win the nomination for U.S. Senate to run against Susan Collins, a crucial race to take over the Senate if the Democrats have any hope of that. And there's a lot of enthusiasm for, at least at the primary level, for that kind of progressive insurgency, the Zoran Mondami kind of progressive insurgency.
People who want to actually do things.
Right. Whether that translates into a more broadly motivated Democratic constituency is the big question. I mean, with all of this Republican redistricting going on, the pathway forward for Democrats to win is to actually campaign, is to actually try to motivate voters, not rely on demographics to seal their victory. And the open question going into this year is whether all this alienation and voters running away from Donald Trump translates into a strong ground game for Democrats, and maybe translates into a strong ground game with Democrats combined with unaffiliated voters and more moderate Republicans just staying home.
Now, look, in the couple of minutes we've got left in this tight-packed program, let's get to the real filth. The $1.7 billion that the Justice Department is about to distribute to Trump and his allies. For what reason?
This is so complicated and so outrageous, it's very hard to pack in.
Two minutes.
Trump has been suing the IRS, claiming that the government seized way too much tax money from him a few years ago. At the same time, he wants to give a whole bunch of money as quote-unquote settlements to people who were accused in January 6th insurrection trials, etc., right? And the two now have been blended together in what is being viewed as a settlement with the IRS, in which Trump will withdraw his suit, which he withdrew the suit this week, in return for the IRS creating this Justice Department slush fund to people who were supposedly wrongly convicted or who've been pardoned by Trump, all those January 6th insurrectionists. Look, it's outrageous. It is also probably illegal. And if the trends we have seen in recent months in the federal courts continue, there are going to be a host of court rulings, you know, cases and rulings challenging this. And it is very important to remember that despite the high-profile couple of Supreme Court victories that we've talked about, on one case after another, most recently just yesterday, the enforcement of immigration deportation arrest orders within federal courthouses, the Trump administration keeps losing and losing with ever stronger wording in rulings and injunctions by federal judges. So, you know, whether this goes forward is a question, but it's one of these big Trump symbolic gestures toward his MAGA insurrectionist base.
Bruce, thank you once again. Bruce Shapiro, contributing editor for The Nation, executive director at the Global Center for Journalism and Trauma. Back in a couple of weeks. Coming up, John Safran on the limits of offense. calls himself in his new doco a provocateur, but really John Safran is a pest. A splendid pest, giving fools the shits for nearly 30 years. Remember the day at the MCG he flew a remote-controlled seagull with a cigarette in its beak out to Shane Warne at the crease? Or having himself crucified in the Philippines with real nails driven through his hands and feet? Or finding a witch doctor in Mozambique and bathing himself in blood to lift the curse, apparently the only thing holding back the Australian soccer team, the curse? Wild and offensive stuff. I've made a career out of blasphemy and offence, he admits, but he wonders, in the wake of the laws passed after the Bondi terrorist attack, if his career is about to be terminated, ditto the careers of all of those who live by the notion of the freest possible speech. So he's made a documentary for SBS to explore what can and cannot be said in Australia today, where we draw the line. It's called Shut Your Big Fat Mouth, John Safran. And he joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Now, look, gate crashing has been one of your trademarks from the earliest times. And in the doco, you talk your way into a do on the Gold Coast, billed as the Free Speech Summit, where you hear its head honcho, a guy called Jamie McIntyre, spouting some rigidage anti-Semitic abuse. The Holocaust never happened, and the Rothschilds are satanic Luciferians. And this is what you say.
Of course, John, you idiot. How was it not going to end up here? It always does.
As an artist, my instinct is to allow more free speech, not less. But of course, more free speech would unleash more tirades against Jews, of whom I am one. This makes things more fraught in pushing the barrow that everyone should just be able to say what they want.
John, what's the it here, as in it always does? What's it?
The conspiracy theory, I guess, always ends up at the Jews' feet, I've noticed over my decades-long career. So therefore, there's a slightly different stake, I think, for me as a Jewish person to kind of just go, well, everyone should just be able to say what they want. Like maybe they should, but it's like ridiculous to like not bring that up in the equation.
So what you're saying is that when you get together a bunch of conspiracy theorists, like the free speech people, these people who call themselves free speech people, it's going to go to anti-Semitism.
It seems to be over, like for instance, I remember decades ago at this bookshop where it was like, I'm all excited because I'm like youngish and I'm into all these things about mysticism and UFOs and conspiracies or whatever. And I'm at the bookshelf at this strange bookshop in Melbourne and it starts off with, you know, aliens, are they real? And
yes.
And then it like eases into, you know, the Freemasons and the aliens, you know, how they operate. Then it's just the Freemasons. Then it's going, is the JFK assassination was, you know, who did that? And then, yep, you end up at the Jews did 9/11. it just constantly, no matter what. So, for instance, in the context of this free speech conference that you mentioned, I was expecting, like, I didn't go there because I thought they were going to say anything about the Jews. I was assuming it was going to be things about COVID-19 and about people feeling that they can't say anything that they want about, you know, the vaccination and stuff. And it was, like, when I arrived there, that's what it was.
Forced vaccination.
Yeah, so, and that's what it was, a lot of people that seemed to be on their mind. And then there was a little bit about people feeling they can't say what they want to say about trans issues. But then I'm just sitting down at the main event and then it's like out of nowhere, the guy who's organising the rally, you know, starts going, well, now that we're talking about things, really 6 million? Did 6 million really perish in the whole, you know?
Yeah.
And so
and it's full on.
Yeah.
Full on standard anti-Semitic crazy abuse. You say that one of the purposes of the documentary is to work out where to draw the line, you know, where we draw the line in these things, and particularly in the wake of Bondi, you mention many, many times.
Well, just to, unfortunately for this doco, it was actually filmed and edited and locked off before Bondi. And when I say unfortunately, I say unfortunately for the discussion about free speech. And then it was just one of those things, like, it's got nothing to do with like SBS trying to silence me or whatever. It was just like, you know, there was money apportioned, there were logistic issues. So I was able to kind of plonk in a voiceover here and a little thing there. But ultimately, I mean, I think it shows how this conversation is just, there's something about it that all this was able to be filmed and edited and locked off before Bondi, and still just with plonking a little bit there, it just seems super relevant to the moment.
But for a couple of years before Bondi,
yeah,
the most urgent free speech issue in this country is what can be said about Israel and about Jews.
Yeah.
And yet you don't explore that.
Well, that's not true.
No.
I've got the dude who took the Israeli flag with the Star of David substituted in
with a swastika,
and I showed how, or you know, I explored how that makes this whole thing of banning the swastika symbol fraught.
Yep,
because the thing is, in the actual law, it says you're not allowed to display. And by the way, there's different laws for different jurisdictions.
Yes, so
please just accept them.
Talk about the law in a general sense.
In a general sense. So you're not allowed to display a swastika, but you are allowed to display a swastika if it's in the service of
attacking
anti-Nazism.
Yep.
So therefore, that sounds like, oh, that sounds easy enough. So if someone's got a swastika with a stroke going through it, then you are allowed to show that because that's showing you're against the Nazis or whatever. But then what happens when someone at a pro-Palestine rally comes with a flag that has substituted the Star of David with a swastika on the Israeli flag? Because from his point of view, I think his name's El Yazbek, from his point of view, so he was the protester. His point of view, he's going, well, the Israelis are the Nazis, so therefore by me displaying the swastika in this form is me opposing Nazis. But for people who are, you know, supportive of Israel, or for other people, they're going to look at that, or maybe Jewish people more generally, they're going to go, no, you're just displaying the swastika. For us, the way we're reading and interpreting is you're weaponizing the swastika in its conventional form. So it just showed how trying to, like, litigate and make these sharp rules on things is just so fraught.
And you do that, and you also look at Nazi gestures, and there's a very amusing sequence about the Sieg Heil and, you know, how to do a proper Sieg Heil. That's right. Okay. But the important issue here is not whether we can do Sieg Heils and whether we can show swastikas. It's what we can say, what Australians can now say about Israel and about Jews.
Sure.
But you don't explore that.
Well, there is another cut in the documentary, just so the listeners know, where I talk about what happened to Antoinette Latouf and explain how they used that as...
We had her on the show the other day. Very interesting.
Explain how this whole thing of weaponizing claims that if you breach workplace contracts, therefore you're not really suppressing someone's free speech because they're only being booted off their job because it's about a workplace contract agreement.
So it's not really about what either of the people that you interview are saying about Jews. I come back to this point because, John, I think it's really crucial. I would look to you for guidance on where the line is drawn about what can be said about Israel and what can be said about Jews in decent, perhaps rough and tumble conversation. And this documentary doesn't go there.
I think it's a bit of weird when I can just instantly pull out that we talk about El Yazbek and his swastika at their pro-Palestine rally, and we talk about the Antoinette Latouf case. But anyway, maybe a slightly sideways way of looking at it, I'd be going, because I'm a bit of a 90s kid, like I'm not just...
I want to explore the 90s.
So you can't just sort of like essentialize me, to use some academic language, essentialize me as a Jew. I am a multitude. And so
I'm not essentializing you as a Jew.
So from the point of view of me being a 90s kid and growing up with that subculture of button pushing, and like the most obvious example is hip-hop, where suddenly you have to grapple with this idea of there's this music that seems very inflammatory, very violent in some cases, and you have to process it and go, well, this is storytelling, this is the context. I can't just dismiss it instantly because of... And I was totally willing to buy that. Also, for instance, in high school, I went to a Jewish high school and we learnt about Shakespeare and we learnt that, oh, he might have said this stuff in Merchant of Venice about that sounds a bit spicy against the Jews or whatever, but I kind of was told, oh, there's a context for things. And anyway, I basically was happy with this whole thing of like, yes, absolutely, you can push buttons. And so from that point of view, when we get to like modern times, 2026, I'm like, just as a 90s kid, he's going, well, you know, I don't mind about people pushing buttons around Israel. If, you know, and like, I've got a right there. Like, it's not this big like drama for me, but I would say there has to be a bit of equality in poking bears. That's where it gets a bit weird. That's just my personal thing.
Mm-hmm.
That, so for instance,
the bear poking test, yes.
Yeah,
I like
this. So for instance, just say the Biennale is every so often it gets in trouble for, you know, there'll be people in the Jewish community go, well, you know, why is there this artistic work that features this terrorist or whatever? Or why is this DJ saying glorify the martyrs or whatever like that? And then, and from my point of view, it's like, oh, that's all fine pushing buttons, but it's like, it's a bit weird. Like the Biennale isn't poking bears around all these other things they could be poking bears. So it's a bit of a...
Does there have to be a quality of bear poking?
I think so, that, yeah.
Well, really?
No, there doesn't have to be, but you have to kind of go...
But there's a kind of interesting war going on at the moment, John.
Yes.
You know, they're the bears out there.
So, but what's your... I've just said that I'm happy for bears to be poked around Israel. So what's the... I don't understand what you're asking.
I have not understood an aspect of your documentary.
Yeah.
Where I was looking for help on an issue that confronts us as journalists every day.
Yeah.
Pretty much every day is an exaggeration, but often. And I didn't find the help that I was hoping for from there. And I was unsure, and you've clarified now, I was unsure how free you still wish the giving of offence to be in that field.
Oh, totally. But as I said, I just feel there has to be a bit of an equality of bear poking in some ways, or else the experiment isn't fair.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to John Safran about his fascinating documentary, which is about to appear on SBS, called Shut Your Big Fat Mouth, John Safran. John, what do you understand the connection is between that's offensive and that makes me uncomfortable? Are you interested in that comparison?
Well, I am interested in, I don't think that things that are on the veneer come across as offensive are necessarily what we should be worried about and are offensive on a deeper level. So I'll give you a real clear-cut example.
Yeah.
Is if you're a politician, you can be in parliament and you can send people to war and use all the nicest words, no swear words, use euphemisms, be very polite. So you're not being offensive on a surface level, but obviously you, on a deeper level, that could be really offensive.
Oh, yes, if you know how to do it.
And then equally, you could just have people who aren't as, you know, quote unquote, educated, you know, and they don't know the clever ways to express yourself. So they might express themselves in rougher ways with swear words or whatever, or with more, in more kind of rough and tumble ways. And so on a surface level, they can sound offensive, but maybe what they're calling for isn't offensive. So yeah, I think offense is a very bad barometer of what's offensive.
Because it's a two-way thing, isn't it? If I say I am offended by what you say, this is a statement about both ends of the conversation, isn't it? It's about me and it's about you.
Yeah.
And therefore, as you say several times in the documentary, it's such a subjective measure.
Sure.
What's offensive?
But I think I'm a storyteller, and I think Australia is so behind, lacking in like discussions of the different angles of offence, that if I do a documentary, I tell a story and go, well, you know, if you consider this, you also have to consider that. And yeah, like the big one being about around religion, where it suddenly becomes, okay, if we're going to try to comb out homophobic hate speech, that's like a slow-moving train crash towards having to address, well, what's in the Bible, the Quran and the Torah, and the fact that, you know, in churches, mosques, temples, synagogues, you have preachers quoting directly the most popular holy books that have what through 2026 inner city secular modern eyes just seems like the worst of the worst homophobic hate speech, like talking about that men should be killed if they... So if they engage in gay sex. So therefore, I think that was in fact the initial thought of why I wanted to do this doco all these years ago, was it was about how religion seems to be dodged around when, like, it's just too hard. And like that. So, yeah, and so that's an example of what I think, what I was trying to get from the doco. I wasn't like, what the hell am I? It's not my fault, David, that I can't draw all these lines about exactly where what's in and what's out.
No, no.
But I kind of think, I don't think anyone wants that from me except for you. And I also, I just think it'd be...
I've always turned to you for guidance, John.
I just think we just have so few conversations that aren't, like, I feel like most conversations, in so much as there's conversations about what's in and what's out and what's free speech and what should be accepted, what shouldn't, I feel like they're generally often overgeneralizing. They're sort of like fake conversations where there's two sides in usually a political or maybe a social issue, and they're just arguing about what they would want to argue about if they weren't talking about free speech. And then for temporarily they're going to like put it through the vector of free speech. So for instance, I'll give you an example. Just say some, if there's like, well, should people who are anti-abortion, should they be able to protest in a street where there's an abortion clinic, right?
Yep.
And then the conversation is more often than not, and it's going to be like, oh, we're having a conversation of free speech and should they be, but then we're not really. The two sides are going to be people are pro-choice, people are anti-abortion, and they're just going to be fighting about that issue and just temporarily using the vector of the conversation of free speech as the vector for that moment.
It seemed to me that you were defending the right of churches to put gay kids or gay men and women through their kind of reassignment rituals, which are held to be remarkably cruel and are now against the law in a number of jurisdictions in Australia.
No, I think you're verballing me a bit. No, what actually happens in the documentary, dear listener, is that I point out that there actually are laws in Victoria that seem to, and definitely religious ministers, both Christian and Muslim, take as they are not allowed to quote from the Bible
when counselling gay kids.
Yeah, but that's not... Yeah, I mean, but they feel that they are not allowed to, if a gay person comes up. But by the way, I'm not even against what you're saying. I'm just saying that this is...
This is there. This is happening.
This is happening. Yep. That they feel like they can... Or that they are convinced. And also, this is a conversation, by the way, like that... religious ministers of different faiths, they're all having behind the scenes.
Oh, and in public.
Yes.
Yes, it's been a debate that's been going on for years.
They feel that they are not allowed to say, hey, gay person, seeing you've come to me and you're asking me about my choices, they feel they can't say, there's some evidence that they feel they can't say, well, actually the Bible says here, in Leviticus 20:13, that it's a sin, and so from their perspective, they're having their free speech infringed.
Yep. John, what's wrong with offending people? Anything?
You want to make these huge blanket statements, but I would say
general principles.
No. General principles, oh God, you can tell you're a lawyer. I think generally my rule book would be more like this. It would be things like if what you're saying has subtext, you get bonus points for that, like as opposed to just doing some anarchic offending. So if what you're trying to say has a point, you get some bonus points for that. And maybe your offence is valid if, you know, especially in the arts or whatever, and in storytelling, if you're trying to make a point. And then I guess the other thing is if you kind of are operating in good faith, and one way you can operate in good faith is by showing, just say, like if your argument is like there shouldn't be offence, that's fine, one thing. But if your argument
wouldn't be mine.
If the argument is there should be offence, I think you've got to show a bit of good faith that you're not just doing it in some self-serving way over some, you know, like you just hate some minority and you're just going to target one minority. And it seems like a bit better if you spread around your bear poking. It just seems, it comes across less icky and comes across like you're more acting in good faith. And an example of that would be, I mean, I'm sure lots of people are familiar with my work and that I like being irreverent and questioning religion, but people have said this to me. It's like, well, why do I get away with it? And one of the reasons I think people think I get away with it is that I spread it around a bit. It's like, it's not like, oh my God, I lay into the Hindus 73 times in a row and I'm just saying, oh, I love being offensive. And it's like, well, yeah, but how come you're just offensive to Hindus? You know, like sometimes someone will see one of my sketches and or one of my pieces of work from over the decades and I might post online and go, ooh, I see John's happy to rile up the Christians, but very interesting, he wouldn't say that about the Jews. And then someone will follow it up with 70 links to 70 times I have. And then someone will go, oh, very interesting that John won't go there with Islam, isn't it? And then like someone will link to me putting a fatwa on Rove McManus or whatever. Anyway, The long and the short of it, I think if you're going to be offensive, I think you get some points, and if it shows you're doing it in good faith and you're not just doing it as an excuse to just target a very kind of one group of people.
Thanks, John. Thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Sure.
I've been talking to John Safran, whose film, Shut Your Big Fat Mouth, John Safran, has a first showing on SBS on Sunday the 24th of May in the top slot at 7:30 p.m. and then will be available constantly and forever on demand. This is Late Night Live. Coming up, The Search for Blind Freddy. You still hear it. Blind Freddy could have told you that. It's a sharp reproach, Australian made, calling some idea or conclusion or point of view so obvious that even a blind person could see it. Since the expression popped into the language before the First World War, scholars wondered if there ever was an actual Blind Freddy. Perhaps it was a Sydney hawker selling razor blades in town, or a blind fan of boxing called Freddie Solomon, again in Sydney. But Adrian Mitchell, author and teacher of literature, has another candidate, Freddie Pottinger, idiot son of the aristocracy, wastrel, gambler, and a notoriously inept trooper in the goldfields. Adrian makes his case in an elegant history just published by Wakefield Press, Blind Freddie, the Pottinger Attainment. And Adrian joins me now. Adrian, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you. Thank you, David. Good evening.
Now, look, let's clear the ground. This Blind Freddy had to be well known. So
yep,
a hawker right. and a boxing enthusiast doesn't cut it.
But Blind Freddy, it has to be something that is really taken the attention of interstate, not just Sydney.
Yes.
And Freddie Pottinger did it in spades.
Well, just before we get to Freddie Pottinger, tell us about Freddie's family. His father has a notable role in the establishment of Hong Kong.
Yeah, yeah. That was a real discovery. And I didn't know any of that when I first got going. His father, a really strange young fellow. He'd come from what is these days the wrong part of Belfast, but then was a lot more respectable. And he got himself out to India to make his fortune in the East India Company, and worked his way up that career. It was almost an alternative to the British government and British public service, the East India Service. And he started off, had an ear for local languages. He got himself a job as a translator, and he got himself involved in what he was translating, and bit by bit he parlayed that and his early career, he's in all the moves that are important in the British establishment in India. When he went home, he'd done well enough that his was a name that you weren't going to forget. He'd got a knighthood out of that. I mean, why else would you go and do that sort of thing?
Well, apart to make
from
money.
The silver plate and so on, yeah. Getting a knighthood is another way of making money too, I think. So he was asked to go and serve the British interests again because China had misbehaved, and he came back to apply the blowtorch of British authority to the Chinese, because the Chinese had done the impossible thing. They'd dropped $20 million worth of opium down the sewer, and the people who owned that opium wanted some of their money back.
Those people, of course, all being British.
Yeah, all of these people are British. And all this goes back to behind that tea. The British had to earn enough money and do it
from opium,
fair means or foul, to pay for the tea.
But we are getting to this man's son. So he becomes a baronet. He's important. Mm-hmm. He plays an important role in the establishment of Hong Kong.
Yep.
But then he dies, and his title and his fortune are inherited by his son, Frederick, whom we shall refer to as Freddie. What did Freddie do with that fortune in the 3 years after his father died?
Well, it's a good question. I don't think any of his father's fortune was used to pay off a particular gambling debt. Freddie did a thing that he placed a bet that is just short of $1 million on a horse, and it didn't win. And someone had to pay the bookie. The horse should have won. I mean, everyone knows that it should have won. Yeah, indeed.
Especially with so much money on it.
And it was such a close thing, it nearly came second.
Yeah.
So Freddie was suddenly, he was in trouble. He was in trouble with lots of lesser debts as well. But he had to pay that off, and he used his mother's jewels for that. And if this sounds like every mid-century, 19th century novel about a rogue that you've read, well, Freddie was, you know, he was up there in the front row with them all. And in fact, he was doing this slightly ahead of the books that would immediately come to mind.
Therefore, he was a model for it.
Yeah, that's right.
And what does a man who has dispersed his fortune almost instantaneously and used his mother's jewels to pay his debts, he goes to Australia, does he not?
Yeah. But what he does is he goes to Australia with an accent. So he's been sent to Eton. His father has, what has been pointed out to the family, an unfortunate Irish accent. And so we can't have the son having that. So the son goes to Eton, and he ends up, can you imagine someone speaking like a cross between Boris Johnson and Prince Harry? So that's Freddie in disgrace for various things, for having set up an establishment with a young lady that he can't afford and so on. He's out of there. The family don't want to know him. He goes to Australia. And how does he get to Australia? Well, he wins a race just before he leaves, and that means he can travel first class. But
he leaves his title behind, at least at first.
Well, he hides it. That's
yes.
right.
So he
uses
Mr.
his initials, but not the title. You don't actually know how much these yobbos down in the southern hemisphere know about what's going on in the northern hemisphere. So you, just in case, it's a good idea not to have too many fluorescent lights on. Got himself to Australia at the wrong time of year, or got himself to Melbourne at the wrong time of year. It was very wet, very cold, and decided that he'd go to where it was even colder and go up to the southern districts in New South Wales and see if he can get him a job. Getting somewhere close to gold, not actually digging it out himself, but guarding it after someone's done all that hard work.
So,
as a way of getting started, he becomes a mounted policeman.
So he gets a government job.
Yep.
And isn't this just the absolute blueprint of the broke aristocrat in disgrace, whose family want him out of Britain, comes to Australia, gets himself a minor government job. So he's got enough money to eat and drink. But for his name to become famous, he has to have become infamous. What did he do? Let's cut to the chase here. What did he do that made him so well known in Australia?
Well, he gets started, as you say, and he's... His place, his first appointment, his first serious appointment, is where the Lambing Flat riots are taking place. His job is to establish law and order on the goldfields there, and he's right in the thick of it, and he's just the man for the job because he had been trained for about 4 or 5 years in Britain, in the guards. He was a big boy, and he knew how to look after himself. So he knew how to show and tell others how to do some of that looking after too. So he's in the middle of all that, and he's the glamour boy. And in fact, he's sent a letter, self-addressed letter, care of his boss up in Bathurst. But it says Sir Frederick Pottinger, and nobody knew he was in Australia. No one heard of this guy.
Yeah.
So that established excitement all the way up to Government House. I mean, the point is that with a title like that, Freddie was quite possibly, don't know, but quite possibly the equal of the governor socially. So we better start looking out for young Fred. And young Fred gets anointed. He's going to be the star of the new look police force that gets put together in 1862. And the very week that this is all going to press and announcing it all, Freddie disgraced himself again. I mean, Freddie disgraced himself. He sort of repeated himself, but with useful variations, which wouldn't be boring. He played billiards. I mean, that's what you do when you've been to Eton and you've been to the guards, and there's got to be a point.
And you're bored and you're drunk and you're probably betting something on it.
Well, something like that. So at 3 o'clock in the morning, he's still playing, and he's playing against the local sharp, and he accuses Freddie of being a shonk, of cheating. Well, Freddie didn't take that too well, and suddenly there's a to-do in the pool hall, and Freddie is belting this guy with his billiard cue and chucking his head through the window. And so he's a disgrace, and that's why he got sent to this awful place, Lambing Flat, and he's got to work his way into, got to become a good guy.
Yeah. And up
the road is Frank Gardner, the famous bushranger. Yep. I mean, that's why Freddie's out there being an inspector. He's got to stop bushranging because they're striking gold up in the Mar Hills. And so this starts the first of a series of escapades. Frank Gardner keeps on tormenting Freddie by pushing things in the local press about how Freddie missed him again. And some of those are quite
Freddie's
funny.
So Freddie's name is getting about, and it's being attached to the notions of failure.
Yep.
And then comes the biggest gold robbery in the history of the colony to that point.
Yep, that's right. It's a doozy. It's a doozy. There's a guy called Ben Hall, who we've all heard of, who appears somewhere out in the background to have pinched Freddie's horse. And it was an expensive horse. But Freddie took a dislike to Ben Hall straight away, and he also took one to Frank Gardner. Those two put their heads together and organised this heist just outside of Eugara, and it was good. Found perfect place to hold that up, and it was again and shocking. Massive amount of gold got taken, and the bushrangers have escaped with the gold. And if I might just sort of notice here, because I'm sure it's going to come up again, bushrangers. They did a lot of firing of guns. There was a lot of bang, 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 but people didn't actually get hurt too much. It's a curious thing. And the inspectors used to fire at the bushrangers, and there was no report of bushrangers going around to emergency services. I don't know what it was all about, but I've got a theory. Anyway, one poor fellow got shot he actually did get shot, and he got shot in an intimate part of himself, and it probably meant he wasn't going to be riding a bicycle for a while. But he's the only policeman I can find any wounding for in this whole saga. So Freddy is chasing after where he thinks the gold has been taken to, because there are footprints in the mud, and there's another fellow, a black tracker, I have a lot of time for, and I don't know, you come across Billy Dargan yourself. He seems to have been an absolute star at his job. And he basically said, nah, they went this way. Well, Freddy being Freddy knows better than that. So he'd headed off for where he was sure Gardner had gone to, which is Victoria.
So he headed off in the wrong direction.
That's right, and in the wet weather. And by the time he worked out that he was wrong and turned around and came back, he ran into a couple of bushrangers who were leading horses with gold and money they can't count to and so on. He had actually got ahead of the bushrangers somehow or other and turned around on his way back feeling sorry and miserable. There they were. So he had another bang, 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 and that went on. Nobody got hurt and the gold got saved, but people escaped.
But in the way of these things, instead of Freddie being congratulated for this stroke of good fortune, he was pilloried. Still, for having ridden off in the wrong direction. And this is where, as I understand your argument, you are building up the notion of a publicly acknowledged fool.
You've got the professional questions. I'm just setting out on the table all this sort of layering of how I think it's almost impossible that anybody else could be such a deal as Blind Freddy.
And I've read your professional writing, sir, and you have laid it out. You have laid it out convincingly. But I'm going to call a halt to this conversation because what we have given people is a taste of this extraordinary colonial comedy, which we have this gorgeous little inheritance of even today. Blind Freddy, this is the man, a drunken, gambling baronet who got a few things right but was nevertheless mocked across Australia for what he got wrong.
Yeah. Like a lot of them, he actually did start to go sour towards then. Well, you would.
Yeah.
Enough's enough. You would. But he tipped Ben Hall's girlfriend out of Ben Hall's cottage, and Ben Hall was not going to be staying there anymore, to others, tipped her out in the cold middle. She'd had a new baby, tipped her out in the rain and set fire to the cottage so they couldn't move back in. That was considered poor form.
Mm.
I don't understand why people would think that.
Yeah.
And bit by bit, he started to show that his hair was getting ruffled. But the great piece at the end of his career, he decided the only way to catch bushrangers was to tempt them into showing off, challenge them to a horse race. There was a horse race. He was going to enter in, and he reckoned the bushrangers would come in and try and show that they could ride better than he could. Well, the word got round. Everybody thought there was going to be a great old shoot-up. John Gilbert dressed up as a lady again. I mean, there's so much going on in the Australian bush. I do not understand how people could be amazed that Auntie Jack got invented.
Earliest days of the colony. It's all there. Adrian, I hear the despair in your voice, but it is a despair of somebody who's done a good deal of laughing and a great deal of research and writing. And thank you very much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Well, I thank you, and I hope everybody gets a chuckle.
and perhaps has a look at your book. The book is called Blind Freddy, The Pottinger Attainment. And in the distinguished scholar Adrian Mitchell's view, this is the man that has given us, even to this day, the taunt of Blind Freddy. And that's the show. On our next, I'm sitting down with Roddy Doyle, a great writer in that nation of writers, Ireland. For 40 years, books have poured out of him, it seems, almost every year. Books that became films, books that have defined his country for the world. Roddy Doyle is visiting for the Sydney Writers' Festival and comes, of course, with a new book, The Women Behind the Doors. Thank you.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.